Most of you know that we do work with Tibetan refugees in India and Bhutan and Nepal. This singing bowls come from Tibet. And after the closing of the class, you may want to look in the center. There's a medicine Buddha that's been etched into it. And the mantra is running around the edge of the bowl. So it's said that these are used in healing in Tibet, which is a much more subtle form of healing than we see in the West. They use vibration and sound, herbal therapies, with great success, actually, to even curing diseases or putting them in remission, like tuberculosis and different forms of cancer. Sound is also one of those elements that's used in healing to kind of realign the vibrations that maybe are aberrant or disharmonious. So allow, can you hear a background? Allow the sound just to come to you and enter wherever you feel you can welcome it and to offer whatever you might need for healing and balance. So those of us that know the Sufi invocation of Hazrat Anayat Khan, let us say that together. And I invite others just to bring about in their own hearts and minds a kind of invocation, invoking those beings that have inspired you along your path, and invite them, invoke them to be here in our presence to guide us for these few hours together. Towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. Reading from a book by the title The Flower Garden of Anayat Khan. This is from a book, though, an excerpt from the book In the Eastern Rose Garden. And it's noted that in the second edition, it's on page 220. And in the first edition, it's on 159. Therefore these, the ears of whose heart listen to the word of God, have first accomplished stillness in their life. And what an atmosphere such persons can produce, what effect their presence has. And it is more than healing, more than medicine. A man, a woman, with a perfectly stilled and comforted and rested mind, will at once raise up another who is going through distress, or restlessness, or pains, or ill temper, or worry, or anxiety. The very presence of one whose mind is stilled gives such hope, such inspiration, such sympathy, such power, and life. All the heaven's properties run so smoothly and freely from the person whose mind is stilled, that his words, his voice, his presence, all react upon the minds of others. And as he stills his mind, so his very presence becomes healing. Isn't it true? So that's what we're doing here for this little bit of time, giving ourselves an opportunity to be stilled. You know, it's only in that stilled lake that a clear reflection can be seen. And this is the part of the work, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this path of Sufism and the message, because Hazrat Anayat Khan didn't talk about a religion. He always said, the message in our time. And he was so very keen on uniting people beyond religious boundaries, discriminations of caste and creed, to finding a way to unify people. And I think, how can that be done? Is that some sort of ideology that we buy into and believe? I don't think so. I think it's something that we feel deeply. And we understand, but why can and how can we understand it? Because we've done the inner work that brings us to that place. That when something comes before that mirror, we just reflect it back. We don't editorialize it. We don't analyze it. We don't come with a judgment. You see what I'm saying? And I think, wow, if someone were to ask me, so I'm pretending you're asking me, what is the most, you know, and this is at my point of evolution. I can't say what it will be in another year or another month or another minute. But I think, and Hakima, I'm interested because I know you've been studying such a long time and had the great opportunity to be with your Murshid for so many years in Australia. But it's like, what would be the one thing we would put our finger on that is, if somebody said, I have one thing I really want to study of Hazard and Icon that would make me become a living expression of the message, I think, what would I want to study? What would I give to a person? And then I think, does anyone have any thoughts about that, by the way, those that have studied? Mm-hmm. If someone came to you, what would you say? It's really an interesting question. May I answer? Do you want to answer, please? You have a thought?
Still not. 2 minutes.
Yeah. I say to myself, it's the thing that teaches us the nobility of the soul and the democracy of the personality. And what are those teachings? There's that whole body of teachings on moral culture and the art of personality. Because it's by changing ourselves that the whole of everything becomes changed. There's a wonderful practice. It was one of the main practices that Hazrat Anaya Khan gave. And it's a wazifa or a mantra. In some traditions it's called mantra. In the Sufic tradition it's called wazifa. And one of the main ones that he gave was Fazl Wahabo. Fazl is the blessings that stream down to us and through our lives, and Wahabo is bringing those into a progression in our life. And he said to us, in this way, we see everything that comes as a blessing. And we know that sometimes those blessings come in disguise and can be a bit challenging, yeah? But those are the very things that offer us even more growth and opportunity, isn't it? Yeah. So this is from a little book we've published called Universal Sufism, Path of Breath, Prayer, and Zikr. And this is a small section from the Gathas, and we'll be reading more from the Gathas in a few moments, but I think this is a good thing to reflect upon. Breath is a channel through which all the expression of the innermost life can be given. Breath is an electric current that runs between the everlasting and the mortal frame. Those who have attained any intuition or miraculous power, or any power, have achieved it by the help of the breath. But the first essential thing is a pure channel for a breath. And that channel is the human body. If the channel is blocked, there is not possibility for the breath to flow freely. Air in itself is not bad, but when it touches the earth, it partakes the influence of the earth, and therefore can become polluted. So it is with the breath. Breath in itself is pure, but the channel through which it works is not right. It becomes impure. The breath makes a current through the body. The breath makes a current through the body, and the channel through which it makes the circuit is the spine. The mystics give this channel great importance. They call it the serpent. They picture it as a serpent holding its tail in its mouth.
So it's like this complete cycle.
In almost all symbols, the serpent represents the channel of the breath.
Interesting. Images of the Blessed Virgin show her with the serpent.
We want to say that that's something else, but you see, she was a student of the great mystery. She was a very educated woman. Don't know if you know that, as well as her mother, Saint Anne. How can one study in those mystery schools and not understand the mystery of breath? And then we say the snake is something else. In almost all symbols, the serpent represents the channel of the breath. In the terms of yogis, it's called kundalini. When the channel is made clear by the method of breathing, then this is not only a help to the physical body, but it also opens up the faculties of intuition and the doors that are within, where lies the real happiness of man. In order to clear this channel of all the blocks, the way one must follow the rules of mystical ablutions and of rhythmic breathing. Do you know that term, ablution? Some of you do. There are outer ablutions and there are inner ablutions. The Sufis follow a tradition from the East where people, when they traveled, they were usually traveling on horseback or camel caravans, and when they would come to a place for prayer. And you see this also in the Christian tradition. Now it's become this. You dip your finger in and do this. But the original was, there were these reflecting pools. And if you think about it, you've probably seen things, read things. And people with these reflecting pools weren't, oh, isn't that pretty? They were there for ablutions, meaning ritual cleansing, so that people could wash, you know, their mouths, their faces, their hands, their feet, before they entered the house of prayer. And that's why these fountains we see, even in Europe, beautiful fountains in churches, and then again, you know, in especially the Catholic churches, you always have this water that you bless oneself with. But in the tradition, there are these beautiful pools where you go and you cleanse yourself. So that's ablution. And those of you that are initiates, if you haven't received that practice of how to do that, you should be asking your teachers. It would be my advice to ask you to teach. Because it's very good to have that kind of concentration. It's something that Murshida Vira was rather insistent upon. And in fact, when she taught, those of you that were around and remember her, she often would have buckets of water outside of the dance hall for us to do those ablutions before we entered. It was her birthday this week. God rest her soul. In order to clear this channel of all that blocks the way, one must follow the rules of mystical ablution and of rhythmic breathing. So now this is a more subtle form of purification and cleansing. Mystical ablution and rhythmic breathing. People who cannot understand the subject and who hear and read things by halves say that some chakras or centers are opened by breathing exercise and that many kinds of distress may be the consequence.
So it could be, according to some people's opinions, to awaken something. These wheels start spinning, the energy centers, and it creates like a vortex. Have you ever been at an amusement park where they have the barrels that go around, round, 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 and you're like stuck against it and the floor drops out and you're all like there? Well, it's like that. So anything that, any kind of impression that has gotten stuck, you know, it's kind of like long ago memories. One could say, oh, from this lifetime, one could say, perhaps if you believe in the transmigration of consciousness, maybe from lifetimes upon lifetimes, when those wheels start to spin, it brings that stuff to the surface, you see. So sometimes people are afraid to meditate and be quiet because they're afraid what's going to come before them, you know? I've heard it said, people have told me that. You may yourself have felt that from time to time. So he says, people who cannot understand the subject and who hear and read things by halves say that some chakra centers are opened by breathing exercises and that many kinds of distress may be the consequence. But looking at it from another point of view, one might as well say that the eye of a child should never be opened, because he will thereby be exposed to temptations of all sorts. So now here we know he's talking more about the root chakra, that becoming stimulated, and then sexual misconduct maybe could come after that. So here, all virtue is in self-control. There is no virtue in being dead. I love his sense of humor. You can hear him, you know, it's like, how would he say it? All virtue is of self-control. There is no virtue to being dead. Life is worthwhile only when a person leads it fully. People look for phenomena, but there's no better phenomena than breath itself. I'm reading that again. People look for phenomena, but there's no better phenomena than breath itself. I think I'll read that a third time. People look for phenomena, but there's no better phenomena than breath itself. Because breath is life and light. You see, this gets back to the practice we've been doing. Because breath is life and light, and in the breath is the source of life and light. Here, he gave the teaching, then you see how we know he's also given the practice. So when I always say, don't think of these teachings have been written down in a book. These were oral teachings that were given in the context of practice. So here's the very sentence that we've been practicing for so long. Because breath is life and light, and in the breath is the source of life and light. In the mastery of breath, the secret of both worlds is hidden. And Murshida Vira was also very adamant about this idea of phenomena. You know, people will say to me, oh, I want to learn how to see auras or read people's minds. I said, my God, don't you have enough to do? I mean, do you even know what's in your own mind? Why do you want to know what's in someone else's mind? Right? Oh, my God. But the other thing is, it can be so invasive, and it's just so not practical. It's like, I mean, they must really have some time on their hands. But the point is that Murshida Vira was always pointing out, you know, she was very a good teacher in that she had this expectation that one would, I don't know with everyone, but with me, at least, that I would correspond with her every month and explain what my situation was regarding my practice, and that something would start to happen, and she'd say, don't get caught in the phenomena. What you want is insight. So what if you see sparkles coming out of someone's head? Like, what does that mean? Do you know what I mean?
Is their head on fire? Do you need to get a bucket? Or does it mean something else? I mean, does it mean they're in danger and they need help? Does it mean they're excited? I mean, so it was always like, don't get fascinated with that part because progress gets retarded. Do you see what I'm saying? And a lot of people are interested in that part. I don't know if you've encountered that, but I know from what people say or write. Any comments? So again, we'll read this and then we'll do a breath practice. Can anyone tell me which one we might be doing? Again, let me say that Hazara Naikon talks about the rules of mystical ablution and rhythmic breathing, and he also talks about, because breath is life and light, and that is the source, that breath is the source of light and life, it's called prana, and that the mastery of breath is the secret of both worlds, the seen and the unseen. We say that in the prayers a lot, the seen and the unseen worlds. Now I'm going to read from our little yellow practice manual folder. By the way, those of you that have this, there are a few corrections that I wish that you can get, and if you don't get them, then at spring camp we'll talk and make sure you get them, because there's some things that inconsistencies, and I would rather have you working with the practices correctly. And I know that I sound like a broken record, but once we've all become masters of this, we will no longer have to listen to this teaching. So this again is on the 20 breaths of purification. And he gives these are his point-by-point instructions. This is from instruction papers on the collective interviews. This was given on June 25th, 1926, keeping in mind that Murshid left us on February 5th, 1927. So only 6 or 7 months before his passing, he was giving these instructions to his students. I really consider them quite vital, as they really are the body of the last bits of teachings that he gave to us. So he gives to his students this word. The breath must be rhythmic. Just what he said here. The breath must be rhythmic. The rhythm of the breath must not differ too much from the natural rhythm, a little slower. So you know that I hope you know that you can alter your mind, you can alter your feelings, and you can alter your body by altering your breath. So here it's a way of, you know, it's like taking a jar that has sediment in it and you shake it up and you can't see through it. But if it sits, it will become clear. Again, that stillness that we read about in the beginning. And also, the breath allows that to happen. It allows things to settle down. So, he says, a natural rhythm, however, a little bit slower. It will create more of a relaxation in the body and also kind of a vibrance. So you will get both things from it. He says, the thought must be repeated in each inhalation and exhalation. It is, I inhale divine light and life. And as we breathe out, I radiate divine life and light. So the term switches, okay? So at first it's subtle. Subtle comes light into life, and then it changes. Life into light. And he says, to tell the person, so I'm telling you, that from the air we draw the essence of light and life and love, and that we radiate that when we breathe out. So the first breath, well, the first thing is sitting up straight. Remember, the spine is the conduit. But not, you know, it depends. In the traditional Buddhist practice, they're kind of pretty specific about, you know, raising the sternum a bit. But I don't want anyone to feel artificial. You also should feel relaxed in your body, but attentive, you know. And the breath, the first breath, keeping in mind we're in our natural rhythm and we're breathing a bit slower and a bit fuller. And we breathe in through the nose and out through the nose. There'll be a series of four different exercises. Each one we'll breathe five times. And we breathe in while concentrating on the phrase, I inhale divine light and life. And as we breathe out, I radiate divine life and light. I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. And remember, Murshid Hazrat Naik Khan said to consider drawing in light and life and love. And when we breathe out, we radiate also life and light and love. Allow the abdomen to fill and become quite loose, like a pot belly. And then let it contract as you breathe out. Breath shifts and the breath changes to in the nose and out the mouth in a very relaxed way. And again, concentrating on the phrase, I inhale divine light and life, and breathing out the mouth, I radiate divine life and light. And now the breath changes and you breathe in the mouth and out the nose. As you see, the breath is moving in different directions, whether we're aware of it or not. We're moving the breath in different directions. And again, these ablutions are entering not just our lungs, not just our nasal passage, but it's flowing through these more subtle channels of the body that some may experience, some may not, doesn't matter, it's still useful. And you breathe in the mouth and out the nose while concentrating on the phrase, I inhale divine light and life, and breathing out, I radiate divine life and light. The last breath in this series of breaths is breathing in the mouth and out the mouth while again reciting the phrase inwardly, I inhale divine light and life, and also considering absorbing, being receptive to love, and breathing out through the mouth, I radiate divine life and light. Questions or thoughts or observations or experiences that anyone would like to share? Richard?
There seems to be at times, at first during the exercises, an inexplicable resistance to such an easy instruction. And as I continue to breathe through that resistance, it occurs to me that there has been a tendency to breathe shallower, and in that shallowness of breathing anchors the pain that I'm resisting. And that becomes apparent as I begin to flow into the exercise and as it becomes easy.
Wonderful.
Who's that?
When you mentioned the term inner evolution a while ago, the first thing that came to my mind was the elemental breaths.
Mm.
Did Anayatan refer to these breaths we just did as inner evolution, or was that, am I inferring that? Or?
I inferred that based on this teaching that he gave, where he associated the idea of mystical and inner ablution to the phrases of light and life and breath. So I drew that parallel. I think about these purification breaths, you know, I think about it like if, for example, Aladdin's lamp, you know, which is a wonderful metaphor, because if the lamp is polished, then this beautiful genie, wish-fulfilling genie, comes out of it. Well, what do you think that is? But one's very self. And when you clean the lamp, or if you polish silver or anything, you don't just go one way. You go round, you go up and down, you go this way, you know. I mean, this is what the breath is doing. It's polishing the lamp. Or it's like a lampshade. You know, a lot of times I get that visualization while we do the practice with the lantern. Sometimes even there I polish our little lantern there a lot so that it doesn't become foggy, you know. And we can become foggy. You know, sometimes you wake up and you just feel like there's cobwebs inside. Well, what do you think that is? The channels of the breath have become less utilized when one breathes in sleep state. You see, there it really is like cobwebs inside. Those channels are not clear. And so, you know, a lot of times, and Diane, you probably know this from your yoga practices, I mean, first thing people do that are on a yoga path, they breathe very deeply and expel all the gases from the lungs and replenish it to get that breath moving through the channels. But it's like that, you know, it's like the lantern becomes the light. The light and the life become dim and becomes dim through impressions. It's like dust on our heart or on our light shade, you see. So we're polishing and cleaning it off. What, Mom?
That's why there's
heart attacks
early in the morning. More. That's when the percentage, a lot of percentage. You wake up, you know, you just, and then you get a lot of activity right off. And
any other comments or thoughts? Yes.
You know, thinking. It seems more natural to me to visualize breathing in life and light than to recite the words I breathe in life and light.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's also fine. If you're just for some it might be just that sense, you know, without the repetition of the word. And of course, we all know that there are other phrases that are used that are associated, nur and, you know, high are associated. But again, I think when Hazra Nai Khan was giving the message, again, he was trying to give it in a unifying language. So he gave this phrase. But yes, of course, I mean, sometimes it comes completely as a visualization. You know, and sometimes I've even used that when we do the practice. You know, consider your every cell of the body like a solar collector. And you're just absorbing and then you're just radiating, you know. But you had mentioned the elemental breaths, and that's although the breathing pattern follows the same pattern that we're doing now, it's different. The concentration is different, and the function of that is very different. Because that is really meant to bring the kundalini energy up and into, you know, all the way around through the up the spine and into the head and stimulating those, you know, the hypothalamus, the pineal gland, and so forth.
I think why I said that when you mentioned the inner evolution, I remember when I was Well, first I was doing the elemental breaths in a different manner than you've been teaching, but with the water breath in particular, I remember particularly I was doing a sort of a form of the elemental breath when I was dealing with cancer, and mm-hmm. with the water breath, I was always visualizing washing through all the cells
in right.
the body.
Beautiful.
And
it was useful.
All four, and with all four of them, there was this particular kind of imagery that I was using, focused on letting go of the cancer cells
mm-hmm.
or sending them on their way or whatever. But,
yeah. And that's really beautiful. I'm glad you shared that because, you know, again, we talked about that before, Murshida Vira's idea about the disease starting at a different, you know, certain place within the elemental scale. But yes, there are many things that could be done with these, but what I'm trying to emphasize, of course, I'm not really teaching this. I feel Hazran and Icon's teaching this. I'm just trying to bring forth his teaching. So, but yes, I also have to say, hope I don't get scolded or my hand slapped by anybody, but I feel the teachings are alive, and some we have to engage ourselves. So for you, if it's just visualizing, I mean, how can we all can get the idea of light, but what's life for you, you see? It may be different for each person, but then it involves the creative faculty, and we become engaged, and the teaching becomes, you know, vitalized in that way. So I think it's very good to do that. I think it's good to also know, just like if we were studying piano, to know the scales, and then we can improvise. And that's what we're trying to learn here, kind of the scales, the foundation, on which everything's built, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism. They say, if you just study the practice of taking refuge in the three jewels, it can lead to one's full enlightenment. But everyone goes, oh, yeah, I've taken refuge now, and what's next? Do you know? Give me some tantric, you know, esoteric practice.
You know, when you asked a while back,
yeah.
sort of what if there was just one practice out of the Nighticon, you know, what actually eventually came to me was the symbology of the winged heart. It's in me that incorporates everything. You know?
Yes.
And it's really quite simple. But
it does. Do you want to talk a little bit about that from your point of view?
Well, it's to me the symbology of the winged heart incorporates a breath practice because the wings are constantly rising and falling as one breathes. And Anaya Khan referred to the symbology of the wings as basically, you know, lifting one up into independence and
indifference.
I'm trying to find a different word for indifference, but that's the term to use as independence and indifference. Meaning that, I mean, for me, as the wings lift one, it's like into self-liberation. Liberation, freedom, really, is what I had said was the goal of the path. And then as I breathe out, I find myself moving more deeply into the soul, you know, into the sort of, you know, wisdom and compassion. And then, of course, the star of the divine light shining in the heart is also reflected in that symbol and in the crescent. So that, you know, one is connected with all the illumined souls as well as moving toward the one within that symbol. And it can be a very living experience of just constantly breathing in and breathing out. That symbol just kind of brings the light and brings the liberation and also brings compassion.
Thank you. Yes, it's said that a symbol can possess the content that cannot be expressed but in 500 words or more. You know, it's an embodiment of something. So it's a very... Symbols are very powerful tools. Anyone that studied Jungian psychology also knows that.
But from a design point of view, it's also very true. We're often creating images in one mark that speaks for a whole multi-billion dollar corporation. So now we're reading from my little notes here. The Gathas, and we're on this third series of Gathas, number 6. Breathing and meditation. Why is breath called prana by the Hindus? It is because it brings on the surface the essence from within. It is a current which is running from the outer spheres to the inner spirit. What it brings from the outer spheres to the inner spirit is not nearly so great as that which it brings from the inner spheres of life. Anyone want to hear that again? It's very subtle, but it's very meaningful what he's saying here. Why is breath called prana by the Hindus? It is because it brings on the surface the essence from within. It is a current which is running from the outer spheres to the inner spirit. What it brings from the outer spheres to the inner spirit is not so nearly so great as that which it brings from the inner spheres of life. It's that, I think it's Ibn Arabi, maybe you know Musa or Hakima, that said, seek to know that which transpires behind that which appears. It's kind of like that. You see, if we're just looking at the surface of things or the appearance of things, one can really be fooled. This being the condition, breathing is vitalizing. Naturally, therefore, the breath of a man in sound health must give health to another in his presence. The breath of a mastermind must vitalize the thought of another. And the breath of a spiritual person must illuminate those in his presence. I mean, isn't it true sometimes you haven't been feeling so well and someone calls you or you have a visit and all of a sudden your spirits are kind of picked up and you just don't feel, you know, you don't feel so bad. Or sometimes you have, the thinking isn't very clear and then you talk with someone or you're with someone and all of a sudden things become much more clear. You know, maybe in the presence of your church groups or your meditation circles or your sanghas, you feel also inspired and uplifted. It's like that. But then you see, it's not just we're taking, it's like in the breath, we're also giving and radiating. So if we learn that and we experience that and we can tune to that, then we can also offer that. I inhale light and life, and I radiate life and light. I
had a student come to me last semester. She was really distraught, and she's a very good and disciplined student. She's all discombobulated. And I said, what's happened? And she said, this was at the college. And she said, oh, I've been in the hospital for a day and a half with my friend's dad is very ill, and they're trying to, they don't know what it is. And I looked at her, and I said, this is not only indifference, it's disinterestedness. In the high form, disinterestedness. That's the other word that can be used for indifference. I said to her, and you think this is helping your friend's father? This energy you're putting out, how does it feel to you even in your own body? And she said, yeah, I don't feel so good. My stomach hurts and this. I said, you think that this is helping your friend or your friend's father? And she said, I don't think so. I said, do you think if you projected courage and hope and faith that that might be helpful? And she said, yeah. And I said, I don't know what your belief is, but maybe prayer and radiating that when you go there instead of getting into this hangdog thing is better. And you know, she immediately shifted. She became a happy, lighthearted person. She focused on her work. Because, again, we think sometimes having sympathy is helpful to people. No, it drags them down. And what's more, then we jump on their head because we feel superior. You know that when you're not feeling well or when something's gone bad and people, well, how are you? I don't really want to know how you are. They want to know how you're not. I'm sorry, it's true. It's human nature. We're like animals. If someone has a bone, we want it. Only if it's a good bone. If it's a rotten bone, you can keep it. You see? But again, it's being disinterested. I find it all quite humorous. I can take the rotten or the good bone. I don't care. And people that know me very well know that's true.